This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. Two authors with two exceptional books in the show today. Henry Mantz is the chief features writer for the Financial Times, and he has a new book, How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World. Here are some quotes from it. An abattoir is a disassembly line. Zoos are imprisoned wildlife. Americans spend $100 billion a year on their animal companions, which is double the US overseas aid budget. And we're quite happy to accept that some 1.5 billion pigs, mentally and socially complex creatures, will be killed this year around the world, but regard it as an outrage to slaughter a dog. Henry also says we're the smartest species on Earth, so why do we insist on being the dumbest? My conversation with Henry Mantz on how to love animals in a human-shaped world later in the show. First, my guest is award-winning author Caleb Scharf. His new book is titled The Ascent of Information, Books, Bits, Genes, Machines, and Life's Unending Algorithm. Caleb, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'm going to start by giving you a little story, and I hope this is going to sort of fit in. Well, let's go with it. Let me do it anyway. In my early teens, I made it clear to anyone who would listen that I wanted to go to art school and become a graphic designer. Around that time, one birthday, my father bought me Marshall McLuhan's The Medium is the Message. Now, I mention this because on reading your book, The Ascent of Information, I was prompted to dig out my old, well-read copy of McLuhan's book. And I'm sure you understand the sort of the connection there. But here's something you should know. I thought back then, when I received the book from my father, in my smarty pants teenage mind, that it was hilarious to rename Marshall McLuhan's book to The Medium is the Massage. Of course, the wit may be lost in translation because in the UK we say massage, not massage. Just give me your feedback on that. Not on my wit, of course, but just on the...
Well, it's a good joke, right? Yeah. Of course, why not play on words? That's what we do. So I think it does speak to something important that is, you know, people have long recognized the power of messages, the power of words, the power of art, the capacity of, you know, information to influence us, each other, to influence ourselves, influence the direction of our civilization and culture. And of course, you know, so in my book, The Ascent of Information, it all really began with me as an innocent, sort of suddenly having this aha moment, which clearly other people had to a similar extent, of just saying, well, gosh, you know, I'm a scientist, so I'm interested in how things function. And you look at our species and we do this unique thing among all species on Earth. I mean, you know, there's a reticence to say that we are truly unique and different usually, but in this case, I think it is the case that we generate and use and propagate all of this stuff, all of this information that is not encoded in our DNA, yet it travels through time with us and it just keeps growing, and it's in our language, our symbolic representation, our books, our flash drives, our cloud servers, and all the structures that go into supporting that. And that's kind of interesting. It's clearly given us enormous advantages in the sort of Darwinian evolutionary sense. You know, what I think of today does not have to be thought of by someone in the future, because they can just read what I write about it. And that's been going on since ever. And so we accumulate more and more information, knowledge about the world and how to respond to the world, how to survive in the world, and so on. But it can feel like it's a thing that manipulates us as much as we like to think we manipulate it. And of course, in the book, I go very deep into this, yes, following various scientific threads. But yeah, this idea that, you know, and the way, you know, the medium is the message is an interesting thing, because, you know, the way that information is, I would use the term instantiated, the way it's actually placed in the world can be pretty diverse, can pretty, yes, pretty varied. And that also alters its impact. It alters, you know, its influence on us and on the rest of the world. So yeah, so these are ideas that touch on ideas from previous thinkers. People have talked about an extended mind, for example, the idea that the sum total of our cognitive abilities, it's not just what's going on in our neurons, it's in everything around us as well, because, yes, that's an extension of our mind, our books, yes, our objects, and so on. And there's feedback, right? Our capacity to understand the world benefits from all of this. So yeah, fascinating, fascinating stuff that has clearly led other people in similar directions in the past as well.
Yes. Let me remind my listeners that I'm talking to award-winning author Caleb Scharf. His book is called The Ascent of Information. And then the sort of subtitle, which I love, Books, Bits, Genes, Machines, and Life's Unending Algorithm. I'd like to start at the back of your book. We want to get into it. And at the back of your book, of course, are the acknowledgements. And this, I think, kind of sums up a lot. I mean, it's sort of odd, really, that we go to the back of the book. But here we have where you say, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, Caleb, but just give my audience just a little sort of understanding of what you say. You say, it feels a little odd to write lengthy acknowledgements for a book that, at its core, is all about the universal impetus for generating more information and more complexity in the world. And then you go on from there. And that really kind of, it sort of gives us in one sort of grasp what the book is really all about, except you take us on a wondrous journey. I mean, I'm going to tell you, I just thoroughly enjoyed every page of this book, because page after page, you question and then you explain. Or is it the other way around? You explain and then you question. I kind of, it's like a little bit of both. And honestly, and I'm being serious about this, I read an awful lot, but I had to slow down my reading in case I missed something. Talk to me about packing all that information together in this incredibly fun, interesting, jam-packed book.
Well, I really appreciate that, and it's a pleasure to hear that you got so much out of it. There's a lot going on in this book, and that wasn't what I set out to do. I wanted to explore this idea of our externalized information, what I've ended up calling the data-ome, like the genome, and so on. And what I discovered is that, you know, there are so many threads that you have to pull on to begin to assemble a deeper picture of what's happening with that externalized information. And so, yeah, so the book, right, you can flip a page and you'll jump from, you know, information theory and telecommunications to neuroscience.
Yes. Right?
And part of, as I was doing this, I realized, wow, okay, I'm including all of this stuff. I mean, to some extent, that's who I am. That's my personality. I'm like the dog that says squirrel and runs after the squirrel. And I'll see another one, I'll run after that. And it's how I do my science and so on. But in this case as well, you know, the book is an assembly, page after page, of a coherent, or hopefully coherent, argument or statement about the nature of information and its sort of importance and its weight, if you will. And the only way I could see to do that was to try to make these connections and to, you know, make people work a little bit.
Yeah.
To jump back and see, oh wow, okay, that is actually connected to this other thing. And yeah, you know, I wonder what's coming next, because there'll be something else that's connected to that, all in service of well, as you say, it's trying to answer a question, but also saying, well, actually, we don't know. And actually, isn't this interesting?
Yeah.
And I actually always enjoy, I don't always enjoy books that tell me that this is the answer. Right? And often, especially in popular science books, tend to have this.
Yes.
I'm going to tell you the truth about how the world works. Well, yeah, I'm not sure anyone can do that. It's more interesting to point to the places of question, the places of puzzlement, So putting this together was quite an interesting task. And it, some of it reflects how I think and work, but it also, I think, is a reflection of, you know, the depth of this idea, and that you can't just make a trite statement about, yeah, external information, it's this other living thing, it's this data home, it's, no, you have to really show, not tell. And the only way to show is to dip into these many different facets.
You've just touched on something which I wanted to ask you anyway, and that is, there's so much information in here, and you go from one thing to another, which I just love. But I'm curious to know, Caleb, when you had the idea for the book, and I'm just presuming, and this is a presumption, that you made notes and you drafted this and you drafted that. As you're putting it together, did you find yourself, because it doesn't come across like you didn't know where you were going, but it comes across like you know, one thing led to another. So I'm just wondering, as you're putting the book together, did you keep it contained, or did you allow the ideas to move from one thing to another? You see where I'm going with that?
Yeah. No, much like the argument that I make for the nature of information, I let it spread.
Yeah.
I let it evolve a little bit. No, absolutely. The original outline of the book wasn't so dissimilar to what it ended up being, but it was a little more restricted. It was talking about the burden of our information, the burden on our planetary environment, burden on our behavior, and so on. And examining that was, you know, fairly self-contained, but it became apparent as I wrote the book that there was more to it than just that. So yeah, absolutely. Much like natural selection and Darwinian evolution, I let the book innovate a bit as we went along. And so I certainly found myself, you know, adding branches. I wouldn't say I, you know, leapt from one thing to another, but I added more branches. It's like a tree, right? And originally it was going to be a relatively straightforward tree with a main trunk and a couple of branches. And it got a lot of smaller branches and twigs hanging off it, but they all feed into that central thing in order for you to get to the top of the tree. So I perhaps more than any of the other books I've written, this one, again, you know, self-referentially took on a life of its own.
It's interesting that you've written this book now, because I want to get to that. Let me just remind my listeners, I'm talking to author Caleb Scharf. His book is called The Ascent of Information: Books, Bits, Genes, Machines, and Life's Unending Algorithm. It's really interesting that you've written this book now, considering that we're in the age of disinformation, and not that disinformation is brand new, but right now it's really to the fore with what's been going on politically and on social media, et cetera, et cetera. Any sort of interest for you that as you were writing the book, what was going on right now that you sort of was like, going, good God, I'm writing about this, and it's happening right in front of my eyes.
Yeah, for sure. You know, so I finished writing the book in the summer of 2020 in the midst of a pandemic. I was sitting, you know, actually out in the countryside working on this. It was good I had something to do.
Yeah.
And watching the disinformation and the chaos sort of unfold surrounding the coronavirus pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic. And absolutely, it felt very prescient, because on the one hand, one could look at all of that misinformation and the right, you open, I mean, even now, but certainly during the height of this in 2020, you open a newspaper, you open your email, you look at any social media, there's just the latest update on this, there's the latest, you know, information, disinformation, fake news, pretty overwhelming. The interesting thing is, I almost took a comfort in what I was learning as I was writing, because part of the thesis in the book is the idea that we coexist with this informational thing that is, I call it, as I said, the data ohm. It's like another living system here on Earth. In fact, it may be best thought of as exactly that, but it's in a symbiotic relationship with us. And in symbiotic relationships, the interests of the two parties can differ. Right? What one wants may not be closely aligned with what the other one wants or needs, but it still works together overall.
Yes.
And I felt that what I was witnessing was a situation where that informational side, that data ohm part of this symbiosis, was having a field day, right? It was flooding the world with more and more of itself.
Yeah.
And in the Darwinian sense, that's perfectly fine. That's what it needs to do. It wants to expand and reproduce and fill in every niche it can. We're part of that mechanism. But in this case, some of it's out of our control.
Right.
We might, yes. You know, we might say, well, look, this is the fault of a politician or a software engineer or, you know, the psychologists that work at Facebook to design the algorithms.
Yeah.
But sitting above all of that, there's this grander view that says, yes, and we can certainly look at it that way, but there's something even bigger going on here.
Right.
That is almost beyond anyone's control. As yes. much as, you know, we might blame other people at some level, this is what happens. This is the unleashing of information, which has been going on since ever on Earth, because life at its core has an informational kind of basis. But we're in this period of extraordinary growth.
What I like about your book is that you explain this so incredibly well on page after page. I get more of an understanding. I mean, I love the way that you've written this book. For instance, you begin with your visit with your family, I believe, to Stratford-upon-Avon, and you go into a world that's festooned with Shakespearean knickknacks, and you describe it so incredibly well. And then we come to the last page of your book, and the very last page is the voice of Shakespeare's Brutus from Julius Caesar. Now, I know this wasn't purely coincidence, and I know that you planned this, but the journey you take us on from the beginning, from your visit to Stratford-upon-Avon to a quote from Julius Caesar, is magnificent. I just love the journey that you take us on. Talk to me about that, about the beginning and the end.
Well, the interesting thing is the idea for the book did not come about when I visited Stratford-upon-Avon with my family.
Yeah.
But it was an experience that stuck with me. And so when I sat down to begin to construct the book, you know, I wanted some kind of entry point, you know, some relatively easily digestible way to begin to get the reader to think a little differently about the world around them. And I remembered that visit to Stratford-upon-Avon. It was a few years ago. I took my family. We were visiting England, my two daughters and my wife and I, and you know, we went to Stratford because that's what you do, right? It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And of course, Stratford-upon-Avon is just this hive of Shakespeare everything. You know, you can buy food with a label of Shakespeare on it. And of course, much of it has real historical interest and is the real thing, but it's just exploded into this tourist trap. And it wasn't until, you know, one of the places I really did want to see, and I give this story in the book, was Shakespeare's body is interred in his, you know, in the grave up in the church, Holy Trinity Church in Stratford-upon-Avon, just because, hey, you know, that's as close as you're going to get to this person who was a truly extraordinary individual. And yeah, I had this experience of standing there. It was towards the end of the day because we had to sort of battle our way through everything else before we got there. Just thinking, this is crazy. Right. This entire town and all the people around me, the tourists taking pictures and the groups of people wandering around, we're all here not because of Shakespeare, because he's long gone. I mean, it's because of what he imprinted on the world. It's because of the information that he left in his plays, in his sonnets and so on. At the time, it really struck me as, gosh, you know, I've behaved this way and all these other people behave this way because of this other thing. That wasn't, you know, it's not him. He didn't have a plan for this.
Right.
It's happened after him. And yeah, and that felt like such a beautiful way to come into this, because also Shakespeare was so prolific and he was so insightful and he created so many even turns of phrase that we still use. What an example of informational output or imprint on the world. And then, yeah, to come full circle, you know, I had not planned coming full circle to the quote from, you know, Brutus's quote. It occurred to me as I was thinking about, you know, I wanted some kind of quote at the end. It's like, okay, well, I started with Shakespeare, so what can I end with? And, you know, the quote is about, you know, if you don't really take in what's around you, how can you possibly set sail successfully? You know, you need to take the opportunity to, you know, catch the wave, catch the high tide, to get on to better things. And I wanted to end, because it's a positive note, I think.
I wanted to get to that. Let's hold that thought. Yeah, I want to come back to the positive part. But just before you do the quote, you give us the quote from Julius Caesar, Brutus's soliloquy there. You also talk about something which, for me, has been an important landmark, if you like, in information, and that's the Doomsday Book. You talk about the Doomsday Book, which is a great historical reference to information. I don't know if we sort of recognize, and you bring it up in your book, just how important that document was at the time, but even more so now, how we collate information and how that was put together at that time. I love the fact that you mentioned that. Just expand on that just for a moment, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, well, it was sort of, the Doomsday Book was a nice thing to refer to, because it was a final reminder that none of this is new, per se.
Yeah.
We've been doing this for a long time, but also there are key innovations that have happened in our data and in our use of information. And the Doomsday Book is a good example, because it was one of the first times that information about ordinary people was pulled together.
Yeah.
It was pulled together because someone, wanted to raise money to go to war and, and exert power. Yeah. But, it's one of the first times that very thorough information, right down to the personal level, sort of fine-grained information about the lives of people in the kingdom, was pulled together. And so it was this enormously powerful thing. And it also set a precedent that I think we still, you may not explicitly look back to that, but, when Facebook takes our personal information, or where every time you have to create a new account somewhere online, you've got to put in some of your personal information. A lot of that threads back to the Doomsday Book,
and
the structure they developed for assembling that information. And they didn't know it at the time, but that really was a template for so much of what came after. So I wanted to kind of bring it down to earth and remind us, if it wasn't Facebook, it would be, William the Conqueror.
Yes, right. Or William the Bastard, as you mentioned in the book. Caleb, because of the lack of amount of time we have, unfortunately, we can't get into all the different areas of your book that I would really like to get into, because quite honestly, we could talk about this and get into it in great detail for another couple of hours, because there's so much to talk about here. But there's something you touched on just a few paragraphs back, and that was, despite everything, this is my takeaway, despite everything that you explain in your book, you are optimistic about our future.
Yeah, no, I part of who I am, I want to be optimistic in the end. And then I also felt in the book, it was important to give some pointers, because it can seem so overwhelming. And the fact that our data ohm is, because of its resource requirements and energy requirements, is part of what's changing our planetary environment. But it's also important to recognize, possible futures and things that might, end up being okay. And, in the really grand scheme of things, I guess the most positive idea that I had for this, and this is looking well into the future, I think, but the idea that, if we're in this symbiosis, everyone has to bring something to a symbiotic relationship, right? Or else it falls apart, even if our interests are somewhat divergent between us and the data. But the one thing that humans contribute that thus far no machine or algorithm or artificial thing has the capacity to do, and may never have the capacity to do, is to be genuinely creative, to produce endless novelty in the world. And that's something we do effortlessly. We're so good at it. And in computer science, it's called the open-endedness problem, because nobody has really come close to constructing artificial systems capable of this. Systems that, we are good at not only solving problems, but thinking of what the next problem to solve should be. And that's such a vital thing.
Yes.
So my optimistic take on this is, we're not going to be subsumed or absorbed or, made extinct by information and machines, because we bring something super important. That's our ability to generate novelty and to be creative. And that's something that maybe only biology can do. So in a sense, we might be preserved. And the best things about us are the very things that save us in the end.
Oh, you explained that so well. Really appreciate that. I'm just wondering, is Datome, is that how you say it? Datome?
Yeah, Datome.
Is that your own word? Is that a made-up word from you? Did you copyright it? Did you copyright
it? Yeah, really. Yeah, no, I made it up. Because I needed something to shorthand this. And it's a combination of data. Well, you know, an ohm means a sort of totality of something, like a genome or a microbiome. And it's not the most, it doesn't trip off the tongue beautifully, but it's about as close as I could get to a term for this.
Yeah. Copyright it, would you? So we can reference you every time we mention it. I wanted to ask you very briefly if you could tell my listeners just a little bit about yourself. Just give a, just if you couldn't, wouldn't mind, just a very brief overview of you and your background.
So I was born in England. Actually, my father is American. My mother is British. I grew up in England, and both my parents were art historians, academics. And so, you know, I was the oddball because I was interested in science.
Yeah.
It wasn't rebellion or anything. It was just interest. And so, I grew up in a little village in England and pretty rural area called Norfolk. And then I went on to university. I studied physics and at Durham University in England. I went to Cambridge to do a PhD in astronomy. And so for quite a while, I actually had a pretty flourishing career as a cosmologist. So that's kind of hardcore astrophysics. Yeah, so I've pursued scientific research all my adult life. And then in more recent years, I've become interested in writing. And I've discovered that I really enjoy doing it. It's sort of therapy for me.
Yeah.
And this latest book is just one consequence of that. It's sort of interesting, peculiar journey through science and thinking about the world.
Well, I'm so glad that you did. You took that direction because you write incredibly well. I think one thing that my listeners need to know is that the way you have written this book, the way you've put it together, it's very engaging. It's a very engaging writing style, and I think that's very important. Something else, another takeaway for me, is that you left me with the thought that we're very strange creatures, aren't we, human beings? We really are. But at the same time, gosh, isn't it? It's also just amazing. I wake up every day thinking to myself, wow, it's so amazing how much I'm going to learn today. If you don't learn something every day, more fool you, I guess.
Yeah.
Caleb, it's been an absolute delight talking to you. You're a wonderful guest. The book is called The Ascent of Information, Books, Bits, Genes, Machines, and Life's Unending Algorithm. Caleb Scharf has been my guest. Thank you for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much for having me.
All the links to the books and music we feature on Life Elsewhere are always up at lifeelsewhere.co. Coming up, Henry Mance on his new book, How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World. Right after this.
You're listening to the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B. Diamond in the back, sunroof top, digging the scene with the
gasoline. My guest is Henry Mance. His book, what a lovely title this is, How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World. Henry, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really glad you like the title.
The first thing when I looked at it, first of all, it was like How to Love Animals, and then in a Human-Shaped World, I was like, oh, okay, got it. And then reading the book. Now, I'm sorry for this. I'm sorry that what I'm about to say, but I devoured your book, and I'm sorry because I'm using a reference to eating, and eating comes into your book a great deal. It's an exceptional read. It really is. Now, you, in my opinion, you managed to give the reader so much information, detailed descriptions, and you do this with such finesse, and it reads at an incredible pace. Would you mind if I give an example to my listeners?
Please, please do.
Okay, here we go. This is early on in the book, and you write, in the weeks of lockdown, the meat and dairy industries choked up. Vats of milk were poured down drains. Pigs needed to be depopulated because farmers could not afford to feed them. One Iowa factory farm killed thousands of sows by blocking up the airways to their barns and then turning up the heat till the pigs effectively cooked to death over several hours. Millions of hens were killed by being sprayed with foam, similar to used in fire extinguishers. This wasn't cruelty-free meat. It was meat-free cruelty. I love that. Oh, my goodness. What a great paragraph there. Let's get into it. You work briefly in an abattoir, and as you describe, a disassembly line. Talk to me about working in an abattoir.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I would say to anyone who wants to work in a slaughterhouse is that it's pretty easy to find a job in one. So, you know, if there'll always be a slaughterhouse near you that needs people. And that's because people don't tend to stay very long and they don't tend to like the heat and the smell. As someone with no experience, with no references, and they were like, okay, here are a pair of boots. Here's some overalls. Get on the production line or the disassembly line and start taking these animals to pieces. And I mean, it's obviously shocking. It's obviously, you know, your senses are overwhelmed. There's so much noise and so much smell and like a thickness to the air in there. But the people I worked with were good, hard workers. And, you know, the book isn't criticizing people who work in slaughterhouses or who work on farms. It's just saying, is this whole system necessary? Because it's a brutal system.
Yes.
You know, it's we're killing billions of animals a year for our appetite. And, you know, do we have to? No. I mean, we choose to do so. And also, does it fit with who we see ourselves as? Because the book's called How to Love Animals. And it's a play on the fact that people call themselves animal lovers. They'll say almost like a verbal tick. Oh, I love animals. I love animals. Yes. Is this your dog? I love animals. And it would be like a sign that you're a good human. And that's true right the way up to the White House, where you see Barack Obama and Joe Biden, and indeed almost every president apart from Donald Trump, adopting pets. So that they can say, look, I care for animals. Of course, I care for humans. And I think that we need to think about whether we're animal lovers in theory or just in practice.
Yes. And that's the big takeaway from your book. And I love the way that you explain it throughout the book. Also, you talk about zoos. Now, this is an area that I, as a child, I remember my parents taking me to Regent's Park, to London Zoo. And I always, and I'm sure I wasn't alone in this, Henry, thinking how sad these poor creatures are behind bars and they just look so miserable. I love what you've written about zoos. Can you just expand on that for us?
Yeah. And I think, Norman, you would have gone to a zoo perhaps a few years before I did, but I think zoos were really miserable. And I think they're not all as miserable today. But I think the really interesting thing is to recognize that zoos were not created. London Zoo, which we both went to as children, but no zoo was really created to help animals. And like when London Zoo was invented founded in the 1820s, the idea was to showcase animals to a public who hadn't seen them, you know, who didn't have TVs, who didn't have YouTube, who didn't have Instagram, who didn't know what a giraffe looked like and wanted to know. And when a giraffe came, of course, school children crowded round and were desperate to see. But we don't need to do that anymore. And I think also we know so much more about the inner lives of animals. One of the amazing things I came across is the fact that elephants live longer in the wild than in zoos. Now, look, in a zoo, they have all the food they want. They have medical attention. They have no threats from other animals. And yet they don't live as long as they do in the wild. And they suffer more health problems than they do in the wild. And why is that? It's because it's just not a natural environment for them.
Right.
It's too small. The floors can be too hard. The climate can be completely wrong. And that they live in social groups, in herds in the wild, which we simply can't replicate. And especially, you know, if you've got a zoo in the center of a city, which is the best place for it from a business point of view,
right,
you know, get as many people in as possible. Well, that's the worst place for it from the animals' point of view, because they want space. And they can't have it in the center of the city.
When you did the piece on zoos in your book and doing research for that, were there any surprises about zoos, about people's attitudes towards zoos? Were there things that you sort of went, ooh, I didn't know that?
Yeah, I think the facts about elephants, or the truth about elephants, is ones that I just hadn't processed. I think many of these questions are ones that, like, we sort of pinch ourselves afterwards and we say, well, why didn't I think about that? Why didn't I think of the fact that animals would like space, or that they would, you know, why did I not notice that animals never run in the zoo? You know, that giraffes never run in a zoo or move as naturally, or that cows don't play as naturally in a factory farm as they might if given plenty of pasture. And yes. I think simply we don't think about these things. And for me, I think on zoos and on lots of other things, one of the interesting things is that friends of mine and people I've came across who aren't particularly interested in animal welfare or animal rights, but they have felt a sort of sense of unease. So as they've gone to the zoo as adults, they've gone because they want a good afternoon. And they had that feeling that you had as a child, which was, this doesn't feel quite right. This feels like someone on the other side of the cage isn't that happy.
Yes.
And I think what I'm trying to do really, and what I felt I'm doing, is pushing it an open door. That if you feel uneasy about a zoo because you've been to one recently and you sort of thought, is the tiger pacing up and down because they're happy, or are they pacing up and down because they're sad?
Yes.
And I want to say, well, look, you can look at it from the animal's point of view. And there are some amazing reserves in the US that offer a really good habitat for elephants. And, you know, one of them really cuts the visitors out, you know, so you're not allowed to go and visit. Yes. And unfortunately, they're just incredibly expensive. If you wanted to keep elephants well, you just need far more space than we're prepared to give them.
Right. Yeah, as we're talking about zoos, it sort of segues in and how we think about zoos and think about animals in cages. It sort of segues rather nicely into how we think about pets and what we do with pets and how we treat pets, which goes then links right back to what you said earlier on about how we don't think about animals. We love animals. We say we love animals, yet we don't think about animals unless they're our pets. You write about how, and this just boggled my mind, you say that Americans spend $95 billion a year on their animal companions, which is double the USA's overseas aid budget. That just blew my mind. I knew we spent a lot of money, but I had no idea it was to that extreme.
And the pandemic has been an amazing time for pet companies. I mean, that figure is now above $100 million a year for the first time, wow. $100 billion a year. So wow. We're really talking, and I see this as a great sign of our love for animals. The fact that people, you know, often without loads of money will make sacrifices to pay medical bills for their dog or their cat. You know, they'll want those animals to be comfortable. And I guess I think that we can use that as a springboard in a couple of ways. One is to say, look, if we recognize that our dogs and cats have needs, that they benefit from certain luxuries, that they have personalities, that they're individuals, then can we also recognize that about farm animals? And if so, we can recognize that keeping cows indoors their whole lives on hard floors, as many happens with many dairy cows, is just not a good life. And you know, keeping pigs, who have some of the cognitive abilities and the emotional abilities of dogs, in kind of metal crates that stop them from turning around, that's not a good life either. So I think we can use it as a springboard in that way. But I also think we have to think a bit about the type of dogs we buy. You know, French bulldogs are incredibly popular. You know, they've amongst celebrities, but amongst ordinary pet owners. And I think, unfortunately, they're not healthy dogs. You know, their faces are really too flat, which means their airways are constricted. Sometimes their eyelids can't quite close. And I think if we love our dogs and we love our pets, it shouldn't just be about what they look like. It should also be about the feelings they have. And some people say we like humanize our pets, and we do in many ways. We think they can understand us, we think they have personalities, and we're right in that, and lots of things. But we would never breed other humans for their looks, and yet we do that with our dogs. So I think we could actually humanize our pets a little bit more when it comes to breeding. You know, I'm a big fan of mongrels, and I, you know, my heart sinks a bit when I see these dog competitions, these dog shows, where unnatural breeding is seen as some kind of achievement. And I think we should say, no, what are we really breeding for? If we're breeding for looks, then that's not so good. If we're breeding for some kind of personality traits that might help them in the modern world, living in cities, living in noisy environments, then there might be a rationale for that. But there isn't. You shouldn't be breeding a pet dog for a certain kind of look, because that's no benefit to the dog themselves.
Yeah, such a good point, Henry, and something that we could obviously go off on a tangent, and I'm sure you've thought about that, so that whole subject. Let me remind my listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is Henry Mance. His new book is titled How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World, and it really is an absolutely terrific read. You're not evangelical about your thoughts about animals at all, but you do get some points across. You get a lot of points across. And you also tell us all about the contradictions about how, and as you just touched on, that we're happy to accept some, what is it, 2 billion pigs, is it, that we kill them each year, but we get sort of nutty about the idea of certain people's killing dogs. I mean, the contradictions are just absolutely crazy.
Yeah, I think, you know, what we've done over the past 200 years, I mean, it's 200 years since the state of Maine passed a law against cruelty to animals. And that was really one of the first laws. So 200 years, we've kind of been very good at legislating and punishing cruelty. So if you do something cruel to an animal, and imagine if it's caught on social media, well, then you'll be vilified. You know, yes. There was once an incident of a woman who was walking down the street, and she saw a pet cat, and she picked up the cat and put the cat in a bin. And this went round, it went viral, and everyone said, how awful can this person be? And I mean, it's obviously not something I would approve of or do, and I don't know what was going through her mind. But I think that that's a very convenient way of us kind of pretending the problem has nothing to do with us, to pretending that we're not people who are harming animals. And like, so we like to campaign very much against people who shoot elephants in Africa, or people who eat dogs in parts of Asia, or people who do mistreat animals in our own countries. But I don't think we ask ourselves the hard questions about, you know, is it fundamentally right to eat meat, and is it fundamentally right to eat dairy? And I think if we did, we would really change. And so we are just very good at a species at holding contradictory ideas in our head. And what I'm trying to do in this book is in a humorous way, and you know, and also in an open-minded way, because I used to eat meat, and I've done all the things. You know, I used to go to zoos. I've done lots of things which I would now regard as not so ethical. But I'm trying to say, look, pause, think. If you love animals, just give a little bit of your time to thinking how you could make life better for them. And if you spend so much on your pet, then how about spending a little bit of money on conserving wild animals? Because what we really need to do is safeguard some wild spaces, you know, create some national parks, more national parks, and give those animals a chance. Because our model of progress has been very good for us. You know, we've become richer and healthier and live longer, but it isn't great for other species. And that, I think deep down, that is a loss to us.
You mentioned in the book about in the pandemic, the shutdown of last year, that animals started to appear in places we didn't normally see them. Talk about that.
Wasn't it amazing? I'm sure lots of listeners will have an experience of having seen coyotes or monkeys just coming back into deserted streets, city centres. And I think it was a real reminder that, you know, there's a whole other non-human world out there which is affected by us, which is crowded out by us. And of course, look, nobody's saying we should have deer going around city centres. There was a village in Wales, not so far from me, where you know, goats basically took yes. over the town. I wouldn't recommend that going forward. But we can't have animals in every space. You know, it is a human-shaped world is part of the message of the book. But we can find more spaces, and we can, I think, recognize that if we step back a bit, if we're a bit more efficient with how we use land, then that land can be turned over to other species, and they will really flourish there. And I think we will see the benefits of that, because it'll be better for climate change if we have more wetlands and forests. And it also just gives us immense pleasure, I think, to live in a world where
where other animals exist and are thriving. And at the moment, we can delude ourselves a little bit that lions are doing well because we can turn on a nature documentary or that giraffes are doing well. But I think for our children and for the next generation, it will become harder and harder to see this as a planet that's in balance.
I want to get to your being a vegetarian, then becoming a vegan. I want to talk about that. But before we get to that, I'm just curious about how much we as humans, we cannot stop eating meat and dairy products. It seems like it's just, I mean, what is that really about? Because from what I read in your book, it's a very small percentage of people that actually are vegetarians or even vegans. So there is this sort of human need to eat meats and dairy products.
I think there are really interesting points here. And I think, I sort of touch on it from a few different ways. One is that, you know, taste is cultural. So people eat different things all over the world. Yeah. And that's because they're brought up with different things, partly. And so I think we need to recognize that if we weren't to give so much meat and dairy to our kids, that they wouldn't be so desperate for it. That if we, and one of the things I try and do with my kids, although they're not vegan, but I try and acclimatize them to the taste of non-dairy milks. So when they grow older, they won't have the difficulty that many adults now have in changing their diet. Because if you've eaten the same thing for 40 years, of course it's going to be difficult. And I think that's the problem that many of us as have. I mean, clearly, humans have eaten meat for a long time, but we didn't eat it in the quantities we eat today.
Yes.
And, you know, on average, Americans eat nearly twice as much protein as they require now. So you require about 50 grams a day, and Americans eat, on average, about 90 grams a day. So, you know, we don't need to eat all this meat. We can get the same nutrients from plant-based foods. And I think it's one of these areas where society just moves forward. You know, there was a time in which society was a much more brutal place, human on human. You know, we were at war, we were treated each other much less well, women had a much worse place in society. And that's changed. And then I think we should look at our relationship as animals as another place where it's going to change. And actually, you know, meat eating goes back through our ancestors, maybe 2 million years, but actual domestication of livestock only goes back maybe 10,000 years. And then the factory farming that I think is so damaging to animals' lives, that's only a few decades ago. Right. I mean, 100 years or so ago, we hardly ate chicken as a meat, and now it's the most eaten meat. So we have undergone this huge change. And what we're throwing off is not the whole of human history. We're throwing off the last few decades of very industrialized farming, which was a mistake, which is inefficient and basically cruel.
Yes. You know, you said something, Henry, just a moment ago about taste when I asked you that question. And it just reminded me of with my children, I have never had Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola or any of those kind of drinks. So it always amazes people when we go out to restaurants or anywhere, or I go to somebody's house and they say, what would the kids like? And they always say milk, apple juice, water. They never ask for Coca-Cola or any of those fizzy carbonated drinks. And it's purely to do with taste, because now as much older kids, they still don't drink it. I mean, they're just like, that tastes horrible. So yeah, that whole taste thing is such an important part of this.
That's so great. And as you've said, this issue goes really well beyond meat. I mean, like what we eat is not great. You know, this rise of ultra processed food has been really bad for us. And I think sometimes we invent something and then we only realize 20 years later or 30 years later how bad it is. And that's the case of leaded petrol, but it's the case of ultra processed food. It's the case of really high sugar drinks. And I would say part of this book is not really about animals or meat at all. It's about when you have kids, that's the moment to say, hold on, how do I want them to live their lives?
Right.
And could I reassess? And so I would encourage people to use those early years of your kids' lives when you're really tired and exhausted and a bit lost and confused, but use them to rethink how you live, because there is the opportunity there.
Yes, absolutely. Gosh, there's so much to talk about here. I want to throw one word at you very, very quickly and just get a reaction. Fish.
Well, some people say there's no such thing as fish, don't they? Because there are so many different types, and we often just treat them like one.
Yeah.
You know, fish have been an afterthought. You know, they've been because they're. I mean, with a dog, with a pig, with a cow, you can get, or even with a chicken, you get close to understanding some emotion. You can't ask a pig whether they're happy, but you can get you can see real unhappiness, and you can with fish, we haven't done that. You know, we've just assumed, oh, they probably don't feel anything, or and I think it's partly caught up with our relationship with the ocean, which is the ocean's been this mighty force that's threatened our lives, and we've seen it as a brutal place. And, you know, look after ourselves first before we worry about the whales or the dolphins or the fish.
Right.
But this is a really new frontier. And I address it in the book as, you know, now there is a pretty good consensus. It's not everyone agrees, but pretty good consensus that fish feel pain. And if fish feel pain, then the way we fish them is inhumane. Because even in slaughterhouses, they make an effort to kill animals quickly. You know, you don't just drag out a pig's death. In a slaughterhouse, you try and do it quickly. Fishing boats don't do any of that. They will drag fish along for ages. They'll leave them to suffocate if they have to out of the water. And so I think we need to rethink the way in which we fish. And then fish farms have real welfare issues of keeping these animals all together. They've been sort of this huge a drive to create to produce fish from farms because the ocean simply can't sustain more and more fish being taken out. And unfortunately, those farms have some of the same problems that livestock farms have. You know, if you keep animals together, they won't be happy that it's a breeding ground for disease, for parasitic lice in the case of salmon. And so I think, you know, we are opening our minds a bit. We opened our minds to mammals and to birds, and I think now to fish, and one day even to, you know, insects like bees are capable of amazing cognitive feats that we hadn't thought of a few years ago. Now, I'm not saying don't crush a mosquito or don't crush a fly, but I am saying, look, there is a real learning curve we're on about just how complex other animals are, and I think that we should find that really inspiring and enriching and also humbling about, you know, we are not the only intelligent beings on this planet. We are not the only emotional or social beings, and so let's not act like we are.
Yes, it's interesting. Just as a side note, I just did a conversation with an author that's written a book about who aliens are and how we treat. Very similar. The premise is very similar to your book in some respects. And he ends up saying that maybe we should look at animals a little bit differently because they could be what we consider to be aliens. They could be like what we consider, say, salmon to be or octopuses to be. And I love that sort of that thought. It's we only have a short amount of time left, and I got this is the sum of the takeaway, and I guess it is the main takeaway for me from your book, that despite all the horrors that you report on in the abattoirs and how we treat animals, you're relatively optimistic, it seems to me. But I think the big takeaway is that you do stress the urgency that we need to make changes, dramatic changes in how we treat animals and how we work with animals, how we live with animals.
Yeah, I wrestled with this a lot. And it is an optimistic book. It's also hopefully a humorous book. I've tried to make it as fun as possible. I don't want to give people this guilty feeling about their relationship with animals. I mean, like, it is funny, really, how we act towards other species. Two things make me really optimistic. One is that there are just so many signs that we care about animals. And like social media has made this so apparent to me, looking at the amount of pictures people share about animals, how clips go viral, etc. So that's the first thing. And the other thing is, what's good for other animals is broadly good for us. So climate change is a real threat to animals and to many species. But fighting climate change will be good for us. You know, we farm in an unsustainable way, and correcting that would lower the risk of pandemics like COVID-19. And so, you know, if we got rid of factory farms, there wouldn't be these breeding grounds for disease. And so I think we can see our interests and those of other animals tied together. And that wasn't always the case. There was a time, obviously, when we were competing for resources with, you know, wild animals bigger than ourselves or fiercer than ourselves. And we've come through that. We've come past that. And we have a sort of stewardship responsibility now. I've seen so much change. I've seen You know, just in my lifetime, greyhound racing, which, you know, where dogs were not treated well, has sort of fallen off the map. If you go back 100 years, then horses were treated appallingly on the streets of some cities and were treated appallingly in wars as well. And that's no longer the case. You know, if you go back a couple more 100 years, then bulls and bears were tortured in terrible ways for our entertainment. And that no longer happens. So I really think that one day we'll look back and say factory farming doesn't happen anymore. And we'll be proud of that.
I think it's really important that, as you just said, that there's a lot of humor in this book. And that's something which I really want to stress to my listeners. The book is called How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World. Henry Muntz has been my guest. One thing I've got to talk about before we go, and that is the cover. There is this wonderful graphic on the cover. Human fingerprints are arranged as a paw. It's absolutely brilliant. What a brilliant idea.
I'm so glad you like that. I mean, I think we have to find every opportunity to like grab what we have in common with other animals. I mean, even when you get thinking about fish, you're like, oh, right, so they're symmetrical, they've got a backbone, and you start sort of mapping out what we have in common. And this goes back to Charles Darwin, you know, these ideas of, you know, humans are not so distinct. And I think that's a real, it's a humbling thing, but it's a great thing, because then we start seeing emotions and joy and like, worthwhile lives all over the place when we look out the window.
There's so much we didn't get to. I wanted to talk to you about hunting. I wanted to talk to you about your sort of evolving from being a meat eater to being a vegetarian to being a vegan. But let's just say this is just a terrific read. Highly enjoyed it. I just certainly recommend it. How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World. Henry Muntz has been my guest. Henry, thank you so very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Norman, I've loved every minute of it. Thank you so much for having me.
Henry, that was absolutely fantastic. I wish we had an hour because there's so much to talk about here.
Oh, that was great. I've done a few of these interviews today. That was by far the most enjoyable. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, man. I really appreciate that. Very large thank you to my guests, Caleb Scharf and Henry Muntz. And a large thank you to you for listening. My email address comes up in just a moment, so do make sure you jot it down and send me your thoughts about Life Elsewhere. Till next time, be well, be safe, and you know, it costs nothing. So please, be nice. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.